the existence of God turns out to be the most decisive issue of life, because the answer that you give to that one question sets the course for everything that follows. So dealing with the God question then is a kind of structural starting point for everything else. All the big questions then, issues of origin and meaning and morality and destiny, all the secondary concerns too. I mean, questions about sex and gender and liberty and equality and bodily rights, all that. They eventually come down to one question. Are we our own, or do we belong to someone else? Either the creature is in charge, that would be kind of relativism, right? Or the creator is. Either the potter calls the shots, or the clay does. And if there is no God, it's all clay and nothing but clay. Now, there are a few moves that you're going to encounter with atheists that I want to give you some insight on. They are distractions that you're likely to face. I'll then give you some tactical questions that are embedded in the sample dialogues that I told you we do that will help you to get moving forward, yet with minimal risk, okay? So we're going to encounter some challenges. I'll give you some information, then we'll have some guided conversation on how this works out in interaction with atheists. Here's the first distraction. You might call this atheism light. What atheists have done is they've redefined atheism. So, oddly now, many atheists apparently are no longer atheists in the classic sense. In other words, it's not the case that they believe there is no God. Instead, they say, we just lack a belief in God. They don't claim God doesn't exist. Rather, they simply don't believe he does. Okay, these atheists are not unbelievers then. They are just non-believers. And since non-belief is not a claim, remember the person who makes the claim bears the burden of proof. Since non-belief is not a claim, atheists don't have to defend atheism. And therefore, they consider that atheism is the default view of reasoning for people, and that makes their job easier, and that's their strategy here. Now, I personally would never take this tact if I was an atheist, for the reasons I'm going to tell you here. I think it's a distraction. I don't think it's a straight-ahead, fair kind of position. Atheists may lack a belief in God, but they do not lack belief about God, all right? They are believers of a certain kind. They believe there is no God. That's why they're called atheists. The root word theism means the existence of God, and the prefix a is a negation. Therefore, an atheist is one who holds not God, or God is not. There's nothing complicated here. There's a difference between non-belief and unbelief. And so, therefore, there's no refuge here for the atheist. Let me tell you why. If you ask me, say, which rugby team was the best in England, I wouldn't know where to start. I have no information, so I have no opinion. I'm truly a non-believer on that question. I'm neutral. Atheists, though, are not neutral on God. If they were, they wouldn't be writing books and making speeches and doing debates and arguing with Christians, right? Because no one debates about their non-beliefs. There'd be nothing to talk about. Atheists argue there is no God. That's not a non-belief. So here's the simple solution to this challenge. There are only three possible responses to the claim that God exists. You can affirm it, God does exist. You can deny it, God does not exist. Or you could withhold judgment. I'm neutral, either for lack of interest or lack of information. And there are some people that just don't know one way or another. They have no opinion. And now with that insight in place, because that's the problem with this challenge, here's how I'd engage an atheist who makes this move. You mind if I ask you a few questions of that? No, go ahead. Okay, I'm going to make a statement, and I'd like to hear your response to it. Is that okay? Sure. Here it is. God exists. Now, what do you personally believe about that statement? I'm agnostic. I lack belief in God. Well, wait a minute. Agnostics have no opinion one way or the other. From what you said, though, it doesn't sound like you're neutral on God. Maybe I can put it another way. All right. Given the statement God exists, you have three choices. You could affirm the statement, that would be my view, theism. You could deny the statement, that would be atheism. Or you could completely withhold judgment, since you have no opinion one way or another. That would be agnosticism. So, my question to you, do you affirm the statement that God exists? Do you deny that God exists? Or do you have no opinion one way or another? The atheist says, well, like I said, I lack belief in God. Well, wait, I get that. But just to be clear, that wasn't one of the options. Are you saying you have no opinion one way or another? You're sitting on the fence on the God issue? I have no belief in God. Okay, let me put it another way. I believe in God, but you've been pushing back on that. You think I'm mistaken, right? Yeah, I think you're mistaken. So if you think I'm wrong about God existing, then you must believe he doesn't exist, which is why you have no belief in God. Does that make sense? Okay, so that gives you a little idea how I might traffic in that. I'm taking the problem that I see in the view, and I'm using these questions to really to try to keep the atheist honest on this one, because I think this is a disingenuous response. Because both Christians and atheists have beliefs, and those beliefs are at odds with each other. That means both have a view to defend. So don't give in to the atheist here. That's giving him a free ride and letting him get away with the I lack belief move, okay? So be alert to that. Now, let me give you the second distraction. And the second distraction is redefining the word faith. Now, the first maneuver keeps him from having to defend his own view because he's redefined atheism. The second move is an attempt to keep you from defending your view, okay? And Peter Boghossian, an atheist from formerly from Portland State University, defines faith in a very particular way. And here's how he introduces this definition. He said, if one had sufficient evidence to warrant belief in a particular claim, then one wouldn't believe the claim on the basis of faith. Why not? Because faith is the word one uses when one does not have enough evidence to justify holding a belief. End of quote. So that's Boghossian, who's redefining faith as something you exercise when you don't have reasons. Basically, on that view, faith and evidence are at opposite sides of the spectrum. If you have one, you can't have the other. That's the way they define faith. And it's not just Boghossian. It's almost every atheist I've talked to of late. All right. Now, this simply is not the Christian view. Let me just say respectfully, it does not matter how atheists like Boghossian define faith. Or, as it turns out, even how some misinformed Christians define faith. It only matters how Christianity defines faith. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to show you what the Bible understands faith to entail. This is a summary that John gives at the end of his gospel. You'll find it in John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31. It's an important passage. Here's what John says. The end of his gospel, therefore, many other signs, that would be miracles, Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which were not written in this book. So he has seven miracles that he wrote in John, but there are a whole lot more. That's what he's saying. And then he tells you why he included these seven. But these, he says, have been written so that you may believe. Believe what? That Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and in believing you may have life in his name. John says that the entire purpose of his gospel is to give evidence for faith in Christ. No appeal to blind faith here. Biblical faith, then, means active trust. And in Scripture, this trust is based on reasons and evidence, not blind leaps. Listen to these passages. Acts 2:22. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs. Acts 1:3. To these apostles he presented himself alive after his suffering by many convincing proofs. John 10:38. Jesus here. Though you don't believe me, believe the works, that is, the miracles, so that you may know that and understand that the Father is in me. Acts 17. And according to Paul's custom, he reasoned with them from, where'd that come from, right? From the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and to rise again from the dead. Biblical faith is not a blind leap. It is a step of trust based on good reasons. Let me give you a sample dialogue on that right now, and I'll start out as if I'm responding to somebody who claims that faith is a blind leap without evidence, like Boghossian does and other atheists. Well, it seems obvious that we have different definitions of faith here, which is okay, but since we're talking about my view right now, maybe we can use my definition. Well, what's that? Well, biblical faith is trust based on reasons and evidence. It's not a leap. Well, I still think it's a blind faith. Well, what if a person gave you evidence for their convictions? What if I gave you evidence for my own beliefs? What then? Well, then it's not faith. Well, what would you call it? Oh, I don't know. It's just not faith if you have reasons. Okay, since I'm glad to offer reasons for my views, what word would you like me to use instead? Convictions. Okay. Convictions, that works for me. So how about I talk about my convictions and the reasons I have for them, and then you can respond. Now notice, I'm trying to make a point here, which I do. He's not buying it, right? So I'm not going to fuss a lot about the definition. I'd rather spend my time giving evidence, and he can call it whatever he wants. I want you to understand what's going on here. That's a distraction. There's another one, though, a third distraction, and that is claiming that belief in God is irrational because there's no evidence. And the easiest way to get clarity, at least, on the irrational and no evidence charge is to ask some questions, right? And here's my first one. Precisely what is irrational about belief in God? That's the question I want to ask him. You should ask the same thing. And here I'm looking for specifics. It's not enough for an atheist to say, well, that's just dumb. Exactly why is it dumb? What is dumb about it? Here's a few more questions for the atheist on this particular issue, because there's a couple of angles here. I might ask, for example, what specific arguments for God have you thought about? Well, I haven't seen any. Well, if you haven't interacted with the arguments for God, how do you know there's no evidence? Well, I've considered some of them. Good. Okay. Which ones would that be? And what, in your opinion, is wrong with them? How specifically have they failed? Now, you might even ask, what would count as legitimate evidence for God in your mind? That's also a good question. Because sometimes there's nothing that they will allow. You want to know that up front. And it's a question that helps you to know if your friend is even open to hearing evidence or not. The key here is to not settle for vague generalities. Ask your atheist friend to spell out the specific problems with belief in God that he has. And you want him to be clear. You want him to be precise. You want him to be exact about the reasons that he thinks belief in God is irrational. There's one final distraction I want to talk about that, and this is the, let's just call it the one less God complaint. With this move, the atheist points out that Christians don't believe in a bunch of other gods like Zeus or Apollo or Amun-Ra or Baal or Thor, etc. Then he says that he just believes in one less God than we do. So, he concludes, we are basically atheists too, like him. Now, you see me kind of chuckling as I'm going along here. I actually think this is a kind of a silly maneuver, but it has stumped a lot of Christians, all right? And to show you how meaningless this attempt is, think of these claims. All married men are basically bachelors, since they're not married to every other woman on the planet. And people with jobs, they're basically unemployed since there are gazillions of other companies who haven't hired them. And murderers are basically peaceful guys considering all the people they haven't killed. Like I said, this is silly, right? Nevertheless, you're going to encounter this if you talk with atheists. The atheists believe in one less God. Great. That is precisely the difference between an atheist and a theist. And that little difference makes all the difference. There's nothing profound here. There's nothing clever, okay? So here's how I'd address this move in a conversation. Well, you don't believe in Zeus or Apollo or hundreds of other gods, right? Right, I believe in one God, the God of the Bible. So I just believe in one less God than you do. Right. I agree. Why is that significant? Well, it means we're almost the same. You're basically an atheist. So I ask, do you think I'm basically a bachelor? No, of course not. You're married. Well, there are billions of women I'm not married to, and a bachelor has only one less wife than I do. That makes no sense. Right, I agree. And that's the point I'm trying to help him to see. So, both atheists and Christians make claims. Both are required to give reasons for their views. We're ready to do that. And providing the positive evidence for God is our next step in responding to atheism on the street. So let me tell you about my daughter, Annabeth. When she was about 8 years old, she asked me this question. She said, Papa, why is it we believe that God is true? That's the way she put it. How do we know that Christianity, theism, is true? And I answer this question, obviously, for my profession. It's what I write about, etc. But now I got to talk to my 8-year-old and put it in a way that makes sense to her. The response I ended up giving to her turned out to be the best summary of my entire approach to this whole project. What I said to her is, Annabeth, the reason we believe that God is true is because he's the best explanation for the way things are. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment. The reason we believe that God is true is that he is the best explanation for the way things are. In other words, God's existence makes sense of the features of the world that without him would be unlikely in the extreme, okay? It has great explanatory power, if you want to use scientific language. Now, atheism, on the other hand, doesn't explain anything. It seems to me the ultimate non-explanation, explaining by denying that any explanations exist. Now, there are two applications of this principle that I want to share with you here at the second half of our session, all right? I was once asked at a Q&A to give some compelling evidence for the existence of God. Okay? And so I asked the questioner, do you mind if I ask you some questions, right? And I gave him three questions, all right? And here's the first question. Do things exist? Yes, he said. The things that exist now, have they always existed? No. In other words, they came into existence at some time in the past, right? Yes, and so this is pretty much what everybody understands, the origin of the universe, okay? Big Bang, for example. Now, I know Big Bang is somewhat controversial with some Christians, but I just want to note that even secular folk acknowledge with Big Bang cosmology that the universe had a beginning, and that's what I'm trading on here. So now I tell them, this is the third question. What caused them to come into existence? And then I said, and make it easy on you, there's only two choices, either something or no thing. Now, who in his rational mind would say that nothing caused the world? I know there's some people that say that, but really? What's the most reasonable answer? So think about this. If your wives came into the house and they looked in the garage and they saw a brand new Mercedes SL in there and they said, honey, where did that new car come from? And you said, well, darling, that just popped into existence out of nothing. No problem. That's the way the universe supposedly started. No problem for a car. Do you think the wife is going to believe that? No way. This something from nothing option is worse than magic. I mean, magic, you pull a rabbit out of a hat, right? A magician does. But in this case, you don't have any magician. You don't have any hat. You just got the rabbit. You know, the universe coming into existence. No. The argument, by the way, I'm offering now has a name. It's called a cosmological argument. Because if the universe didn't come into existence out of nothing, then something caused the universe, and the something would have to be outside of the universe, and it would have to be really smart, it would have to be really powerful, and you see where I'm going here. To put it most simply, how about this one? A Big Bang needs a Big Banger. That pretty much covers it, all right? And skeptics know this too. Once I was at a dinner party, and a young man sitting across from me announced somewhat belligerently that he no longer believed in God. It's irrational. That's what he said. There's no evidence, etc. And I asked him, do you think the universe banged itself into existence? And he's dismissive of that. Last question I asked him. Look, if somebody were to knock on the door over there across the room, would you think that the knock knocked itself? Or would you think that someone did the knocking and answer the door? No, he wasn't interested in this conversation. By the way, that is not unusual. You'll have atheists make these strong statements and really not want to engage. They just want to say their view and then be done with it. Okay, they're not interested in any responses. All right. So I abandoned the project for a little bit until dessert, and there across the room at the front door you hear... And the young man on the opposite side of the table from me looks up like this and said, "Who's that?" And I said, "No one." Now, of course, the key here is what he did. He got up and he answered the door, because even the atheists knew that a simple knock on the door had to have a cause. The knock couldn't knock itself, all right? Yet he seemed completely willing to accept that an entire universe simply popped into existence without rhyme or reason or purpose. No, atheism cannot explain where the world came from. Theism can. Therefore, theism is the best explanation for the way things are. Here's the point. I don't want you to miss this. No matter what view of reality you take, any religious view or any non-religious view, you have to have an ultimate starting point for everything. If not, you're stuck with what's called an infinite regress, all right? We know that the material universe can't be the ultimate starting point. It has to be something outside of the natural realm, something that can decide to cause everything else to come into being. In other words, someone, not something. Let me give you another argument kind of along the same line, another feature of reality that theism can make sense of better than atheism, all right? And I want to introduce it with a question. How would we know if there is intelligent life in other parts of the universe? Do aliens exist? Well, scientists know the answer to that. We'd know if we discovered something coming from another world that could not have been produced by natural causes. That's the basis for the scientific project known as SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, S-E-T-I. Now, SETI's basic way of recognizing that there's intelligent life beyond Earth was actually featured in a dramatic and kind of fun way in a fascinating movie called Contact. And in the movie, astronomer Ellie Arroway, played by Jodie Foster, decoded a message from radio signals from outer space and discovered a detailed blueprint with instructions to build a spaceship. Now, that blueprint completely convinced her that aliens existed, and for good reason. Curiously, though, Ellie was not convinced about God's existence, and that was part of the movie, part of the conversation. She needed evidence, she said. Yet if Ellie had applied the same rules to the question of God that she applied to the question of ETs, she would have had the evidence she needed. The evidence for the existence of God is exactly the same kind of evidence that Ellie took as proof for the existence of aliens, a sophisticated blueprint. Every single cell in her body carries in it a code embedded in the DNA for a detailed blueprint for a more complex machine than any one for a spaceship, all right? Who combined 3 billion base pair words, so to speak, to write the assembly instructions for human beings? And DNA is just the tip of the iceberg. Signs of intelligence, God's fingerprints, so to speak, are everywhere in the natural world. There's the stunning ability of reptiles, sea turtles, for example, fish, salmon, mammals, whales in this case, and insects, monarch butterflies, to actually navigate to precise locations on the globe by tuning in to the Earth's magnetic field. Huh? It is unthinkable that the same incredibly sophisticated virtual GPS system would independently evolve by accident in creatures far removed from each other on the so-called evolutionary tree of life. Really? So that's one thing. There's also the remarkable positioning of our planet in just the right place in our solar system. It's what even secular scientists call the Goldilocks zone, you know. It's got just the right size. It's got just the right seasons. And these are dictated by just the right tilt of the Earth's axis and just the right magnetic field with just the right intensity and just the right moon, creating just the right tides and just the right continental drift and just the right ratio of oxygen to nitrogen and just the right ratio of carbon dioxide to water and on and on. There are dozens and dozens of these just for Earth and our solar system. And if they didn't have those, by the way, intelligent life on planet Earth would not be possible. All by accident? Really? Clearly, God's fingerprints are everywhere for those willing to look. And there are lots of ways to make this point in conversation. Let me give you one example. This is responding to the there's no evidence for God kind of claim. Let me ask you a question. If you saw a shoe print in the sand on the beach, what would you conclude? Well, I conclude somebody had been walking there. Right. A person wearing shoes. Yeah, that's right. Would you be tempted to think it was a freak accident of nature, seashells, sand, surf all rolling around together, creating the impression that looked like a shoe print but wasn't? Well, that wouldn't make any sense. Why not? There's a better explanation. A person wearing a shoe. Exactly. So let me give you another example. Let's say you found a blueprint of some sort. Would you be tempted to think it was a crazy accident of ink spilled on paper and whipped around by the wind? Of course not. Why not? Well, same reasons. So what do you make of the human body? Oh, it evolved by chance. And the DNA blueprint for the human body inside each one of ourselves? Why would you believe that a human body evolved by chance when you won't believe a simple shoe print in the sand happened by chance? Well, it's possible. Well, let's say I agreed that it was possible, even if it were, which strikes me as unlikely, but even if it were, do you think it's the most reasonable option? Is it the odds-on favorite? Plus, in this case, there's actually a better explanation. What's that? An intelligent creator. So there you have a dialogue playing out those concepts that I was responding to. And basically, it's an answer to Richard Dawkins. Maybe, all things considered, God actually is the best explanation for the way things are. Now, I've given two good reasons to believe in God, the origin of the universe and the dazzling design at every level of our world. Both point to God and not to atheism as the best explanation for the way things are. So let's review what we covered this time. First, I explained why the God question is the most important question anyone can answer. Because the answer you give to that one question sets the course for everything that follows. All the big questions eventually come down to the answer to one question. Are we our own, or do we belong to someone else? Second, I talked about four different distractions that atheists offer that can kind of throw you off the track. They redefine atheism as lacking belief in God. They redefine faith as belief without evidence. They say that belief in God is irrational, and they also imply that Christians are mostly atheists because they deny all other gods but one. The third thing we did is I gave to you two of the most powerful evidences that the smart money is on theism as the best explanation for the way things are, not on atheism. One, I gave you the cosmological argument for God that's based on the origin of the universe. A big bang needs a big banger is what I said. Two, a design argument, also called a teleological argument, based on the powerful evidence for design in the DNA blueprint and in the biological world and in astronomy. In our next session together, I'll give you our final application of our best explanation principle, and we'll use it to describe the problem of evil. Yeah, the problem of evil turns out to be one of the best arguments for theism and a fatal flaw for atheists, not the other way around. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. See you next time.